Before I start on Abraham tonight, mention most of you are probably here this morning, maybe not all of you, but next Sunday night we are not going to have a service here, but I am hoping that we have a great crowd of people that go to Turbotville and visit one of the Nazarene churches on our zone, the Turbotville Mountain, Fairview Mountain Church. It's one of the smaller churches on our district, and I just love for us to come together and encourage them for this zone service. It's a mission service with Brian Hellstrom. We're going to leave here from the parking lot about 5 o'clock. If you want to ride in the church van, you'll have that opportunity. If you want to drive, you'll have that opportunity. It's not real hard to get to. I will have written directions, but I was supposed to have a sign-up sheet tonight, too, and I forgot to. So I never got that done. But we'll just have to see who comes at 5 o'clock. If you really would prefer to drive, I can give you directions and the address, and you can go on your own. But, boy, let's make this a time to support a Nazarene church on our district, on our zone, not far from us. Pastor Marge Fisk has been there and ministering for the Lord, and I just know it could be a good time for us to be together with some other Nazarenes. And we do this about once a year where we have a mission service at one of our churches. We've actually had it at our church about 3 of the last 5 years. That's because I'm the one responsible to schedule it. So I always say, well, come to our church. That's all right. But I can't be so selfish. And, you know, some of our smaller churches do not have missionaries very often. They just don't have that opportunity to do that. And I want to encourage them to be able to. And so let's go together. It'll be dark, of course, but we'll drive together and come back together. Probably be back about 8:30, I'm guessing, maybe 9 at the latest. And let's go and have a good time together. So if you can be here at 5 o'clock, I know that our choir can't do that. They're getting ready for the Christmas musical, and they're working so hard already. So I know that excludes some of our people who would otherwise want to go. But I sure hope that we can have a great crowd that will go. We'll have at least 2 vans to go, and then people that can drive and ride, and invite you to be a part of that. And then also just wanted to mention, I did last Sunday, for those of you that love Southern gospel music, and some of you love that, I know it, and I just want you to know that the Brown family, a Southern gospel group, will be at Country Cupboard. The guys from Country Cupboard sent me a note and said, would you mind just putting this on your bulletin board? And I said, well, I don't mind doing that. In fact, I'd even mention it. Some of you love the Brown family and love Southern Gospel. I just want you to know about that if you're interested. You can call Country Cupboard and get the details or look at the poster on out there. But that's Thursday coming up in a couple weeks, and I thought some of you might be interested in that. Well, let's look at Abraham tonight. Abraham, the father of many nations. Abraham, you think of this morning I talked about how God is our heavenly Father, and we think of God as Father. Well, to the Jewish people especially, and even to many Muslim people, and even to the Christian people in our faith, Abraham has that title, Father Abraham. He certainly is important to a lot of people in our world today. He's called Father in part because Abraham represents the beginning of something, the beginning of God reaching out and beginning a period of revelation, a period of God saying to mankind, I care about you and I want to be reconnected to you. Abraham becomes that person that God chooses to begin that process and represents that timing of God to reconnect with man. There's so many things that we can say about Abraham. Certainly he's the father patriarch, the one who began that line of patriarchs through whom God worked. And many nations came from Abraham, and one of which, the blessed people, the Jewish people, have had a history since then. And they were chosen by God to be a light to the Gentiles, to the many nations. There's so many things about Abraham that we will look at in this series, and we have begun to look at that. We began a few weeks ago to trace Abraham's life. So far, we looked at the first 75 years of his life, where he was born and a little bit about that, and how his family traveled about 700 miles for the first leg of a journey and settled in Haran. And then when his father died, God told Abraham to go to a land that I will promise you. And so Abraham gets up out of faith and takes his family and travels another 500 miles down into the area that we call the Canaan land, the promised land, where God said, I will promise that to you and to the generations after you. Last time we were together, we read these words in verse 8 of chapter 12. There he built an altar to the Lord and called on the name of the Lord. We have this picture of Abraham. We see something about his heart. We see something about his character. We see something about his faith when he comes to the land and he builds an altar to the Lord and worships him. And then he moves on to another place and he builds an altar to the Lord. And we find this throughout Abraham's life. Seems like everywhere he goes, he's building an altar to the Lord. We see in Abraham a great pattern of faith and responding to God. He is worshiping, acknowledging God, seeking God. And in this town of Bethel, in this verse that I read, is where he is building an altar to the Lord. And then in the next verse, in chapter 12, verse 9, we read, it says, then Abram set out and continued toward the Negev. And so tonight I want us to pick up at that part of Abraham's life and what happens in the next chapter of his journey. I said before that there's basically four journeys that Abraham makes, two long ones and two very short ones. And so tonight we're going to look at that last part of Abraham's journey until he comes back to the land that God calls him to, and then he lives out the rest of his life. We're told in verse 9 that Abraham continues toward the Negev. The Negev is that desert area, the southern half of Israel. The Negev, or in the Hebrew, this area is called the Negeg, N-E-G-E-G, and it is a fascinating place. It's not a part of Israel that we usually think about, and a lot of the stories that take place in both the Old and New Testament, we don't think of happening in this area of the Negev, but actually the area of the Negev is a very important part of Israel. The map that you have in front of you tonight, I want to talk a little bit about the geography of Israel and where Abraham's story fits in to Israel itself. The triangle at the bottom is basically the Negev Desert. And if you look at that, you'll see it's a triangular shape, and it starts just about at the southern end of the Dead Sea, although the line from the Negev is not like it's real easy to see. Over time, the line's been drawn differently, sometimes a little bit higher, up toward the middle of the Dead Sea. But certainly from about halfway point of the land of Israel to the south is the area that has been called the Negev. And I want to describe the Negev to you tonight, and I want to show you some pictures from when I was in Israel and in the Negev, and talk about how significant this area is, and it became Abraham's home. The northern part of the Negev became where Abraham spent almost all the rest of his life, except for this time in Egypt, and then for a few stories in the rest of Abraham's life. Abraham spends his time in this southern area, the northern part of the southern area. I had the privilege to spend about six of the days that I was in Israel in the Negev. And it was a fascinating place. It was a remarkable place. It was a place that really, it was a treasured part of the trip that I was there after Debbie and my dad went back home, I continued on and went down to the Negev and had rented a car, and at that time you could drive around, although there were tensions there with the Palestinians, and there were tensions from the Gaza Strip, but still at that time one was able to rent a car and drive in that area, and I'm sure you can't today. I'm sure it's very limited because of all the tensions that have gone on there in the last couple of years, but I had an opportunity to travel that area, and it was a very interesting place. Well, the Negev is a part of Israel. Go back to that picture just for another minute or two, if you would. And I want to talk about kind of how that fits into the story of Israel. Negev is the southern part of Israel. It's actually, although you can't really see it quite on that map, but the Negev is about 55% of the land area of Israel. So when you think of how big Israel is, and then you cut it in half, again, you realize how small the Negev is and how small Israel is. In the Old Testament and the New Testament, this area is called Southern Judea. You see that term in the Bible, Southern Judea. So it wasn't called Negev in the Old Testament, but that's the Hebrew word, how it's transliterated. This area is mostly dry. It's desolate. It's about 95% sand and rocks and looks like what you think of when you see the surface of the moon. That's kind of what it looks like. There's just not a whole lot there. But in patches where it's irrigated or there's a spring that comes up from the ground, then you have irrigation and you have plants and vegetables and palm trees. And so there are little patches all throughout this desert area that are green, but they're very few and far between. And only in some very small areas it's productive and fertile. It has amazing beauty to it. I marveled and took many, many pictures of the Negev and how beautiful it was. And there's some very significant stories from the Bible that take place in the Negev and about that we don't probably hear near as much as the stories in the northern part of Israel. Well, Herod and his whole family came from the Negev. You think about who Herod was, Herod the Great, and that dynasty that ruled throughout the time of Jesus. They all came from the Negev and that southern Judea area. And Abraham settled in the Negev. He settled right on the northern end, kind of about at the middle of the Dead Sea, just off from the Dead Sea. But during the time of Abraham, this was all called the Negev. And both Abraham and Isaac and Jacob all lived in this area. And so the patriarchs, those that we kind of we look to as the founders of Judaism and of Israel, all lived in this southern area that's called the Negev. The town of Hebron, which is about two-thirds the way down the Sea of the Dead Sea, it's almost to the Orange, but not quite. And just off, just a little bit to the left of the Dead Sea, the town of Hebron is kind of the town or the area that was called Abraham's town. It's where Abraham settled, in that area. And he lived all the rest of his life. And so did the patriarchs after him. Well, let me show you a few pictures now of, go on to the pictures if you would, Andy. And let me show you a little bit. I don't know how well you can see. I took probably 150 pictures in the Negev, and I have about six of them I'm going to show you tonight. But it's a very desolate area, and you walk, and you can walk into it, but it's like going into the desert, and you need to be very careful. It can be very cold at night, and then scorchingly hot during the day. One night, I was in a place called Ramon Mizpah, and that was an area that looked over into a canyon. It's like half of the Grand Canyon. I couldn't believe how far down you could see, but it was just a canyon wall, and it went on for about 22 miles. It was absolutely beautiful, and I, with another guy that was there, we packed in, we filled a backpack, and we left about 4:30 in the morning when it was about 30 degrees, and we hiked down into the canyon and down across the canyon several miles until we hit a trail, and then we turned left, and we took that trail out to the road, which is about 8 miles out, and it was one of the most beautiful hikes I've ever had. The beauty of the rocks and the desert was absolutely amazing. It's part of Israel that I'd never realized was there. Go on to the next picture, but there's just lots of canyon walls and rocks, and you can tell that's my picture because that's my finger up there on the side taking the picture. You can usually tell when I've taken a picture, but it's just absolutely beautiful. We wanted to leave at 4:30 for a couple of reasons. One is we were told that the sunrise would be so amazingly beautiful that you had to experience it. And so, you know, I was game for that. And so that's what we did. And we walked onto the what's called the Mokdesh, and we hiked. They had a trail, and we had flashlights, and we had to go pretty slowly in the dark, but we got about halfway down the canyon when the sun started to come up, and it was just one of the most beautiful sunrises I've ever seen in my life. But go on to the next one. Again, you look back. This is when we were kind of going down. There's a trail. You can't see it there, but that's what it looks like once you get down into the canyon. Up in the middle of the picture at the top is a lookout that they've built out of this little village, so that you can pay money and go up there and look into the canyon. We didn't do that. We walked into the canyon instead. But it just phenomenally beautiful. And then we got about two-thirds of the way down, and we turned around and we took pictures looking up at the canyon wall. It was an amazing place. This whole area, the Mokdesh as it's called, there are some beautiful animals there. I just put one in here to show you. This is from the top. After we got out, we hiked out to the road. We hitchhiked back up to the top of the canyon. The road goes south from this area down to Eilat, which is the southernmost town in Judea, in this area of the Negev. But there are all kinds of mountain goats and things around there. And they're used to people taking pictures. And this guy let me walk up within about 4 feet of him and take his picture. I'm not sure what kind, you know, if he's just, they're very tame in general or whatever. But this is amazingly one of my pictures. I don't have my finger in there. But you saw a lot of those types of animals there. And it was a neat experience. And then I think I had one picture of myself, maybe. My friend took my picture. But I tell you what, we started out at 30 degrees, and by the time we got out to the road, it was almost 100 degrees. It was amazing, the change in temperature from 4:30 in the morning till about noon that, or 1 o'clock that afternoon. It was pretty amazing, and it just spectacular view of you know, it almost like being in Alaska. You could see so far. It was amazing. And then I think I put in one more picture of the sunrise. That didn't do it justice, but I took a lot of pictures as the sun was coming up over the mountains, and it was absolutely amazing. Well, this desert, desolate area is where some of the patriarchs spent most of their lives. I think of the patriarchs as being in the land of milk and honey and green and olives and palms and all that, but there's a whole lot part of Israel that is not that lush, green place that we think of. In fact, when I went to Israel, I was surprised at how dry Israel was. And it was in that day, but there were places and pockets of a lot of greenery and things like that. One last picture, and then we're going to move on to Abraham and Egypt, and that is the Tomb of the Patriarchs. In Hebron, which is the northern end of the Negev, is where Abraham is buried and Isaac is buried. You remember that Abraham bought a field when his wife Sarah had died and buried her there. This is the area of Hebron, the Tomb of the Patriarchs, and it's believed that Abraham and Isaac and Sarah and Jacob and Leah and many that we're told where they were buried in the Old Testament, they're buried here at the Tomb of the Patriarchs. However, it's in Hebron, and this is Palestinian-controlled territory and is not real friendly toward non-Muslim people. And I was not able to go there. I could have paid a lot of money and went there. You've got to pay money, and you've got to pay a Palestinian guide a lot of money to take you to Hebron. But at least when I was there, and it's probably even more so now, basically, I would have really had to make it a priority even to visit this area called the Tomb of the Patriarchs. It's controlled by the Muslim people. Of course, they treat Abraham as the father of their religion, as Christians see him, but there are only certain days of the year that they will allow non-Muslims to visit the Tomb of the Patriarchs. And someday, if I ever go back to Israel, I hope I have an opportunity to go back to that area, because it's got so much history, Old Testament history and stories of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and altars that they built and wells that they had and just a lot of interesting things about Abraham. Well, it's toward this area that Abraham goes to settle and will spend most of the rest of his life. But before he makes it his final home, there's yet this one trip to Egypt. This time where Abraham kind of moves on from Hebron and goes down to Egypt for a certain amount of time. I want to read that story, chapter 12, Genesis, and I'm going to read it verse 10. Genesis chapter 12, going to read verses 10 through 20. Now there was a famine in the land, and Abram went down to Egypt to live there for a while because the famine was severe. As he was about to enter Egypt, he said to his wife Sarah, "I know what a beautiful woman you are. When the Egyptians see you, they will say, 'This is his wife.' Then they will kill me, but will let you live. Say you are my sister so that I will be treated well for your sake, and my life will be spared because of you." When Abram came to Egypt, the Egyptians saw that she was a very beautiful woman. And when Pharaoh's officials saw her, they praised her to Pharaoh, and she was taken into his palace. He treated Abram well for her sake, and Abram acquired sheep and cattle, male and female, donkeys, men servants and maid servants, and camels. But the Lord inflicted serious diseases on Pharaoh and his household because of Abram's wife Sarah. So Pharaoh summoned Abram. "What have you done to me?" he said. "Why didn't you tell me she was your wife? Why did you say she is my sister, so that I took her to be my wife? Now then, here is your wife. Take her and go." Then Pharaoh gave orders about Abram to his men, and they sent him on his way, and his wife, and everything he had. This story about Abram is the part of the story, or one of the parts of the story, that I have wrestled with for a long time to understand. What does God say to us about this part of the story? The white line in the picture kind of shows the route, roughly, that Abraham and his family probably took from Hebron, from that area down to the area around Cairo, 250 miles. This would have been a trip through the desert, probably would have been very dry. Today it certainly is a very dry area, along with all the tensions and the Gaza Strip and all the tribal fighting that takes place across the desert. The next map shows a little bit of a larger area and a little bit more detail about the Sinai Peninsula. Of course, today that triangular piece is what's called the Sinai Peninsula. There's a lot of hostility between Israel and their neighbors. On the right, or as you look at that, on the right side is really just a little sliver of land that belongs to Israel. Sinai Peninsula itself is four times as big as the whole land of Israel. So when you think again of how big Israel is, you realize that about eight Israels would fit inside to the state of Pennsylvania. Israel is not a large area, a large land, and all around it has its enemies who have promised and who have said that they want to destroy Israel. But from this area of Israel, Abraham journeys to Egypt at a time of great famine. It would have been a difficult journey for anyone to make across the desert and 250 miles, but we know that there was a great famine in the land. Egypt had a lot of dry areas as well, but still people came to Egypt during times of famine. And all throughout the history of Israel, Egypt became the breadbasket for many people, even during times of famine across the history of the world, and really the last 3,000 to 4,000 years. And Egypt had one resource that most of the countries around it did not have. Egypt had the Nile River. The Nile River was so significant and important to how Egypt was able to weather its famines. You read the story a few generations later of how Egypt also had a terrible famine that God brought on them. And before that, God blessed them and caused them to have so much grain. And they became capable of people coming and receiving grain. And that happened many, many times. It wasn't just in this story that Egypt helped its neighbors and people that were hungry, but this is kind of the story of Egypt. The Nile River would flood every year. The Nile River and its flow was fairly consistent, and every year the Egyptians knew that in springtimes the rains would come and they would overflow the banks and it would flood the plains around the Nile River, and then the grain would be grown, and there was a consistency to that. And so Egypt had a lot of food. It had a lot of food to export, and over the years it did. They had a lot of grain that they were able to export, and people would come and pay for it and pay for a lot of money, because in times of famine throughout that area of the world, Egypt would be the last country to have a famine because of the consistency of the flood. And so Abraham knows that, and Abraham sees, as it's probably dry and throughout the area that he's living in the Negev, there's no food, there's no grain, there's no water, and he knows that he must make this journey to Egypt in order to receive of the food that's there. Later on, Jacob's whole family went to Egypt in a time of famine, and so the cycle has continued. It is a difficult for Abraham, maybe even desperate journey for Abraham to make as he goes to Egypt at this time. Now, there was a famine in the land, and Abram went down to Egypt to live there for a while because the famine was severe. We really don't know a lot about why or exactly the details of Abraham's choice to go to Egypt. We don't read anywhere in this part of the story that God told Abraham to go there. We don't read that God told him not to. We don't read that Abraham asked God for direction. We simply hear that Abraham makes the decision to go to Egypt. Obviously, a lot of people that read this story kind of think that, well, Abraham got ahead of God's plan here, that God could have taken care of Abraham's need. He called him to a certain land and said, I want you to be there. Then Abraham believed that he needed to find food and he would have to move his family to Egypt. Some people think that Abraham was outside of God's will and stepped ahead of God's will. And that's kind of the part of the story of Abraham's life. Of all the things that we admire about Abraham, we also see in his life the tendency to get ahead of God's plan and sometimes not wait long enough for God to do what he's going to do. And part of the example of Abraham's life is what happens when we decide that we need to take action ourselves without knowing and hearing what God wants us to do and God's timing. It's possible that he got ahead of God. But it's also possible that God said it's okay to go to Egypt. We really don't know that for sure. But we do know that Abraham went down to Egypt and there were consequences for his trip to Egypt. There are some things that we know about the rest of Abraham's life and about what happened in Egypt that shows us and tells us that we must be careful about getting outside of and ahead of the plan of God. We know from the story that when he got down to Egypt, he was concerned about his own safety. He was concerned about whether he would be accepted and he could live there and how he would be seen. Verse 11 says, as he was about to enter Egypt, he said to his wife Sarah, I know what a beautiful woman you are. When the Egyptians see you, they will say, this is his wife. Then they will kill me, but will let you live. Say you are my sister, so that I will be treated well for your sake, and my life will be spared because of you. Abraham told his wife to lie so that he could be assured that they would not kill him. I guess according to we read kind of between the lines of Egyptian culture that if a man has a wife and he's killed, then his wife would become the property of Pharaoh, become a property of the king, or could be taken. We don't really know exactly all the culture here and the norms here, but we know that Abraham was afraid for his life. And so he told his wife to lie about who she was. This is my sister. And Abraham allows his wife to be taken into Pharaoh's household. It would seem between the lines that he allows Sarah to be taken into Pharaoh's harem. He probably had many women in his harem and many wives. And that's what the kings did then. And Abraham seems to consent to that. Now, I know that for us to look at this story and decide what's right and what's wrong, we're not sure about how to understand that. We know that he allowed her to be taken into Pharaoh's household. We know that Abraham did several things that we would wonder. I just wonder tonight, as you look at this story and read it, what would you do? Do you believe Abraham made the right decision to allow his wife to go into Pharaoh's household? I'm going to change gears here and I'm going to ask you to vote on something. I did attend the first college class I have been to in 30 years, 3 weeks ago when I went to be with Laura. And now in their class, they all have clickers. And the professor asking questions as they lecture and they're supposed to respond. You know, what do they think about this? What do they think about that? I want to ask you to engage this story for a moment tonight. And I want to ask you to vote. Do you believe that it was the right thing for Abraham to tell his wife to lie in order to protect himself and to allow Sarah to go into the household of Pharaoh? Yes or no? I'm going to ask you to go on the line. I won't take your picture. I won't record the vote. But I want to ask you, do you think, if you had to decide, there's only two choices, yes or no. There's no, I'm not sure, because none of us might be sure. But do you believe it was the right thing for Abraham to do? If so, would you just put up your hand confidently? Yes, I believe it's the right thing to do. Okay, put him down. Put up your hand if you think it's a wrong thing for Abraham to do. Thank you. Okay, it looks like it's about 2-1 vote. Oh, interesting. Here's this man who we revere as the father of our faith. And 2/3 of us or so look at this story and we're not sure what to do with it. What do we say about Abraham here? Abraham had a number of things in his life that seem very questionable to us. And one thing I know about it is I've wrestled with this story and other stories about Abraham and some stories about Jacob especially and some stories about Isaac and his wife and Esau and Jacob and their lying and their deception. And I'm thinking, how do we regard these as our patriarchs? How do we wrestle with that? I may ask you some more opinion questions, but maybe not tonight. Verse 14 says, when Abram came to Egypt, the Egyptians saw that she was a beautiful woman. And when Pharaoh's officials saw her, they praised her to Pharaoh, and she was taken into his palace. When Abram came, maybe Abram was doing the best he could. It may be that we could say of Abram that the decision that he made about telling his wife to lie and allowing her to be taken into Pharaoh's palace, maybe it's the only option Abraham felt he had. You know, I thought about that. You know, if we were back there and we were in their culture and in their custom, would that be the right thing to do? Certainly the norms about polygamy and about all kinds of things are not the same as ours today. Debbie and I've been wrestling with this sermon all week, and I've talked to Debbie about it, and I said, tell me what you think about that. And, you know, how do we hold this? We realize that our norms today are not the same as they were in Abraham's day. And so when we're kind of thinking, how do we process the right and wrong of what Abraham has done? We probably realize that we're not in that culture, we're not in that place, and so it may be a little bit hard. It might be a little bit hard for us to know exactly what the right thing for Abraham to do was. But what we do know in this story, and what keeps coming back to me, though I wrestle with Abraham, is I don't have to wrestle with who God is. Because God has never taken his eye off of Abraham. No matter where Abraham goes all his life, no matter the mistakes, the weaknesses, the getting outside of God's plan, the deceptions that happen, one thing I know in this story is that God has always, always kept his eye on Abraham. God knew where Abraham was. He knew whether Abraham was there because he got outside of his will or not. God knew whether Abraham made a terrible mistake to go to Egypt. I don't know whether God told him to go or not, or Abraham ever asked. I don't know that. That's speculation. But I do know that even in the decisions that Abraham made, God never took his eye off Abraham. He continued to look after him. You see, God had made a promise to Abraham, to Abram. He said, Abram, I'm going to promise you a future generation and all the descendants greater than the stars of the sky and sand of the seas. And I'm making this covenant and this promise to you. God had made a promise, and God was not going to go back on his promise. And even as he went with Abraham to Egypt and all the things that happened there, we know how faithful God is, that God never gave up on Abraham. God never said, Abraham, I can't believe that you would do that. I can't believe that you would tell your wife to lie. I can't believe that you would allow your wife to go in and almost become or maybe become the wife of Pharaoh. That may or may not have happened. We know that God somehow stepped into the story and said, stop. It's going to stop right where it's at. And he brought a plague upon Pharaoh's household. Somehow God saw the mess that Abraham had made. God saw the weaknesses and the problems that Abraham had did, and God stepped in. Even though Abraham's actions could certainly be called unwise and deceptive and imperfect, God continues to work on Abraham's behalf. As I wrestle with the story, I have questions about Abraham, but I don't have any questions about God. Aren't you glad that God is far more dependable than we are? Aren't you glad that God is far more patient with us than we probably deserve? Aren't you glad that there's a God in heaven that's so merciful that even though this man might have done this thing that would have been outside his will and outside his plan, who is God? He's a God that keeps trying, who keeps calling, who never gives up on Abraham. The example in this story is not of how great Abraham is, but how great God is. And so God stepped into the story. Verse 17, but the Lord inflicted serious diseases on Pharaoh and his household because of Abram's wife, Sarah. But the Lord, the first three words of that verse kind of stand out to me, but the Lord. You know, if it wasn't for but the Lord, none of us would have the grace and the ability to know the power and the love and the redemption of God. If it wasn't for but the Lord, there's none of us. None of us are perfect. None of us have lived our life without problems and issues and bad decisions. And I'm thankful for a God who loves us so much that He continues to reach out and call to us. God said, Abraham, I see where you're at. Maybe God said, Abraham, boy, you've really blown it again. But God said to Abraham, I don't want you there. That's not where you should be, and I'm going to bring you out. God steps into the story of Abraham. Maybe in part because Abraham has shown such faith in God. Abraham has done what God told him to do. God said, leave your family, leave your household, and go to the land where I have called you to. Maybe God is measuring this man who has fallen short, and he reaches out and he says, I'm going to bring you out of this, Abraham. So God brings a plague upon Pharaoh's household. God is working in Abram's life even when he falls short. And the truth is, God is working in our lives too when we fall short. It's because you're not perfect and you mess up. Don't think that God turns away from you and says, oh, I don't care about you anymore. You're not perfect. God doesn't treat people that way. But with patience and perseverance and long-suffering, God is calling out to people today. God is calling out to people. God brought Abram out. God is a patient God. He's long-suffering. And His ways are far higher than our ways. If I would have been God and there I would have seen my Abraham, how would have I voted? What would have I said? I don't know. I'm not sure. I kind of with the two-thirds majority, but part of me says, well, I'm not sure. But I do know that God was faithful to keep reaching out into Abraham's life. And He spared Abraham for what could have been far greater consequences than he had. I know God had made a promise to Abraham about Sarah. God had said, you and Sarah are going to have a child, and it's going to be all these descendants. And somewhere along the way, maybe Abraham forgot that. Maybe Abraham and Sarah didn't quite believe that, didn't quite understand that. And, you know, how can this be? And maybe Sarah gave up. She was a beautiful woman, but we know within 25 years from this point, she's described as an old woman, never having a child yet. And maybe Sarah and Abraham both gave up that this could be possible. I'm not sure about that, but I know that God did not give up and God kept His promise. God fulfilled the covenant. Not in Abraham's timing in the way that Abraham's life was going, but in His own timing, in His own way. The truth is, God can be working in ways of your life that you might not see or understand, but the truth is, God's always there. God knows your life and your heart. God blessed Abraham when he didn't deserve it. Come to think about it, God blesses me too. God blesses you when you don't deserve it. I think of what grace is and mercy is anyway in the cross of Jesus. There's none of us that deserve the cross. There's none of us that deserve that Jesus gave His life for us. But in His great mercy and love, Jesus laid down His life for us while we were yet sinners, the Scriptures say. Abraham had the blessings of a merciful God who intervened with the disease on Pharaoh's household. And all of us have the blessings of an intervening Christ who died on the cross for our sins too. And so when we think about Abraham's experiences and how weak he was and things he did, we should just also remember how merciful God's been to us and worked in our lives. About Abraham, we certainly would say he was very imperfect, but God still used him. God still blessed him. God still spoke to him. God still made promises to him. It really is a picture of a different side of God than maybe we think about sometimes. Maybe Abraham did get ahead of God, and sometimes we can think that God doesn't, His timing isn't right for us, but it always is. We also want to think, and I know when I study Abraham and his life, I want to think of Abraham as being perfect. I want to think of my heroes in the Bible as being perfect, but the truth is there's none that are. There's none in the Bible that are perfect. Yet God continued to work through them. I think of King David, how imperfect he was, but God worked in his heart and his life. Think of other stories in the Bible that show us that God is patient and God continues to reach out. God works with imperfect people. There were consequences, though, for Abraham. So let's look at the other side for two more minutes tonight, and then we're going to be finished. But there were consequences for Abraham. The fact that God brought Abraham out of this mess, God reached in with a disease and inflicted upon Pharaoh and his household, did not deliver Abraham from the consequences of his, what I might would call, unwise judgment, however far we feel or would take that. There were consequences about Abraham getting out in front of God several times in his life. Most of them are kind of connected together with a story in Egypt. There's always consequences to being outside of God's will. God often takes the punishment. God often relieves us of the disasters that could happen. In this story, there's so many things that could have happened, but God relieved and stepped in by His mercy and delivered Abraham from that. But yet, there were consequences that Abraham had to live with the rest of his life. Think about the consequences. Somewhere in Egypt, Abraham and Sarah acquired. Think about consequences. And another story that really, I really wrestle with, because it's so real for us today in the world that we live. Somewhere in Egypt, Abraham and Sarah acquired a servant girl. I think it says here, he acquired sheep and cattle and male and female donkeys, men servants and maid servants and camels. Somewhere along the line, this probably poor, innocent maidservant girl. Maybe her family was so poor, she could have been sold as a slave. I don't know. This story is about God's mercy, but it's also about consequences. Be careful the decisions you make, because you never know how one little detail in your life can produce a consequence that will be so painful. God rescued Abraham. But Abraham had to live with the consequences of his decision to go to Egypt and to lie about Sarah. Hagar's story is told two chapters later in chapter 16. It is, I think, one of the most painful stories in the Bible, chapter 16. What happens when we get out in front of God? What happens? There's always consequences in Hagar's story. For whatever you say about Abraham's culpability, it had consequences. And they carry to this very day. They carry to the area of Hebron, where the Palestinians are at war with the Jewish people. The Suez Canal, ISIS at the border of Turkey and Syria, the beheading of people. Consequences. I don't know that I have a good conclusion in my sermon tonight, but it's one that leaves me with a lot to think about. God is merciful, but there's always consequences to stepping outside of His plan. Thankful tonight, God, for your mercy and your grace, that your hand is on us and you're watching us and you're watching over us, and you are calling as a loving Heavenly Father to each one of us to keep our eyes on you and to seek you. And God, we know that you want to help us at big, important decisions in our lives, and even the important, the smaller decisions in our life that you care about. We know that in this world we will have pain and tribulation, but we also know, God, that you can help us to avoid the things that will be so painful and bring consequences that seem so unfair. When we think about people in this story, we think of even Pharaoh, and we don't know exactly about all that he did that was wrong, but God, we know that Abraham's choice and decision had an impact on his household. We think about Hagar, think about later in the story of what happened to her and all her descendants, and how the consequences of Abraham and Sarah's life had such negative consequences in the lives of people from that generation on until today. God, help us to learn from this story what you want us to. Help us to read it and to ask your Holy Spirit to speak to us about our lives and how we live. Help us as we study these chapters in Genesis to be drawn to your heart, I pray. In Jesus' name.